Lights, good evening. Tuesday night Bible study on the Gospel of John. We will be going over the first part of chapter 1. Last week was the intro. And just a very, very brief recap, if you remember, who wrote the Gospel of John? Well, the Apostle John. There's really no controversy about that. When and where did he write it? There is a little bit of dispute over that. Most scholars think he wrote it in the 90s A.D. from Ephesus. However, Dr. Weinrich makes a great case, as I was reading his commentary, that he thinks John wrote it in the 50s A.D. from Jerusalem. And one of the reasons for it, among a few others, is because there's a lot of Jewish references in there. So if you just look at the context, John does point out a lot of the festivals and events on the Jewish calendar, and it would make sense that the Jews would understand that, and the Greeks would not. What is the style of John? I really particularly like this. We talked about enigmatic sayings, very hard, difficult sayings. John doesn't shy away from them. He records all of those sayings of Jesus. You know, when Jesus says, whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood will have eternal life. Ooh, what does that mean? Well, we have a little bit of an understanding, perhaps, afterwards. You know, what is truth, Pilate said? Or when Jesus said, I am the bread of life, what does that mean? I am the good shepherd. So a lot of hard sayings that are good for us to think about. What is the purpose of the gospel? Remember, we went over that. For these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Yeah, I'm not the best voice in here. But that is a good reminder set to music of the purpose. John gives us the purpose right there in John chapter 20. We'll get to that near closer to the end. It's so that you believe, not just his readers in that contemporary time, but also beyond that, throughout history, that you believe that Jesus is the Christ. That's the point. The gospel gives you faith. Outline. We went through an outline last week, the one from the Lutheran Study Bible. I summarized it this way. The outline, the first half of the gospel is Jesus' ministry. And during the course of that first half of the book, as Jesus is ministering, giving signs, which is what John calls his miracles, and teaching, there is rising opposition, rising unbelief. And it is capped when Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. That is a miracle that divides people immediately. You either believe it or you don't. You either think Jesus is the Messiah or you reject him. So there's ministry, comma, unbelief, that's with the raising of Lazarus, comma, then ministry, Jesus' final act of ministry and his biggest act of ministry, the pinnacle of his ministry, to die on the cross for you and me. And so the whole second half of the Gospel of John is devoted to Passion Week. Everything that Jesus did during, from Palm Sunday to Easter. I don't know if you realize that. Because the other three Gospels have a couple of chapters on Jesus dying and rising again. John has half the book. And then the final chapter is belief. Finally, the disciples believe and they get it. Okay, so a brief outline is ministry, unbelief, ministry, belief. All right, make sense? Then we went over verse 1. There it is on the screen. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There is an awful lot in that verse. So basically, just as a reiteration, I would say three things that come out of there. In the beginning was the Word. So in the beginning of time, in the beginning of everything, was, past tense. So the Word, logos, predates creation. And the Word was with God, and I mentioned that word with is actually the word that means toward or facing. So, with is an okay translation. The Word was with God, meaning the Word is not God, but the Word is in relationship with God. And then the third part there, and the Word was God. So, the Word is not God, but the Word is God. Yeah, how can that be? Well, you all know that's kind of the mystery of the Trinity, isn't it? How can Jesus not be God the Father, but be God the Son, and they're two persons, but yet one God? Yeah, boom, mind blower. We can't understand the Trinity, but that's what God teaches us. All right, any questions? Well, that's easy. I've already put you to sleep. I don't even have to go any further. All right, we're going to try and get through the prologue today. This is verses 1 through 18. We just did verse 1 extensively last week, so I will continue on with verse 2 and on. And as I said last week, this is some of the most elegant Greek in the entire New Testament. It's just beautiful. And I think some of the poetic nature of it does come through in the English. You look at this, and it's beautiful. It's poetic. It's meaningful. It's rich in meaning. I have to tell you, just as a little side rant, we were driving Saturday to Ann Arbor for a football game. Yeah, you know, there's a special team that plays in Ann Arbor. And just in case you didn't know, my son is in the marching band there. So just, you know, all right. And it was just her and I, and she started listening to this podcast called The Prancing Pony. You know what that means? Anybody else? Tolkien, yes. It's a pub in The Lord of the Rings. And it's this podcast by these two nerdy guys, geeky guys, talking about all things J.R.R. Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, because a new series came out, The Rings of Power, and is it really Tolkien, or is it faithful or not, and blah, blah, blah. But they made a comment in that that said, J.R.R. Tolkien is one of the most elegant writers of prose in English. And then they quoted some passages of his, and I had to think, you know, that is really beautifully written. I don't know how many of you have read Lord of the Rings. I've read it multiple times. I am one of those geeks, as some of you know. It is beautifully written. This is beautifully written. Okay? It's wonderful. It's elegant. So just to start off, I'm going to read the whole prologue, verses 1 through 18. And you can just listen to how wonderful it is. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness, to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known." Well, that's so wonderful. It's just poetic and beautiful in every way. All right, so let me go back up. We talked about verse 1. Verse 2, he was in the beginning with God. So this verse, it almost seems like a repetition of verse 1, and it is to some extent. It is kind of repeating the first and second thoughts of verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And then verse 2, he was in the beginning with God. However, it does add something extra. It says he. So in the first verse, everything is gender neutral. The Word and God. But now it says he. Huh. So there's an extra clue. Who is John talking about? Who is the Word? We already know the answer. But if you're reading this for the first time, it intrigues you. And he was in the beginning with God. And that word with there in verse 2 is the same word as with in verse 1, pros in Greek. So it means towards somebody, facing towards somebody. Okay? So it has that. So this begs the question right off the bat then on verse 2, who is this? Who's he talking about? All right, then verse 3, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So here there's a shift, a little shift, a philosophical, if I could say, existential shift, because the shift from being, verses 1 and 2 are talking about just existing. Who exists? God and the Word. And they exist before creation, before time. Now, in verses 3 and 4 and 5, we're shifting to the idea of becoming. So from being to a focus on becoming or creating. Okay? It's a philosophical shift in the focus of these. And this shows the purpose of the Word. What is the purpose of the Word? What's the function of the Word? All things were made through him. And without him was not anything made that was made. So, it's still referred to as he. So that still continues to give us, okay, who's this talking about? And if you remember, the word word, which in Greek is logos, the Greeks would think of that word logos, it's was loaded and weighted with philosophical meaning for them. The word logos meant the ordering principle of the cosmos or of society. Words are what order society. Remember I talked about that last week? Both classes. Hebrews see the word logos as the means by which God makes things happen. How does God make things happen? He speaks. Right? He spoke creation into being. How does he forgive you? He speaks. How does he make things happen? He speaks. Not always, but most of the time. So, who is this word? Well, this word, all through him, all things were made. Everything. Through Jesus. Was Jesus there at creation? Yeah. Everything was made through Jesus. And this is both a positive statement and a negative statement. Everything was made from him through Jesus, through the Word. I'm giving it away. You already know the Word is Jesus. And without him was not anything made that was made. So it excludes nothing. It includes everything and excludes nothing. Do you see that there? So it's both sides. It's saying the same thing twice, but in two opposite ways. And then verse 4, in him was life. And the life was the light of men. In him was life. This is interesting. What's the very first thing God created? Light. Right? Life was the light of men. Light is the first thing God created. I remember hearing somewhere, some scientific thing, that without light, if our sun ever went dormant, which, you know, some speculate that in, you know, 20 trillion years our sun is going to go dormant or whatever, and it's like, you know, as a Christian I'm like, we won't be here. It's way too long from now. It's not going to happen. But if our sun ever, you know, died, there could be no life. If you think about it, without light, life cannot exist. In him, who's that him in verse 4? The Word. It's Jesus. In Jesus was life, and the life was the light of men. Which came first, the life or the light? It's kind of a chicken and egg question. Because in creation, light came first. But life in Jesus, the Jesus life, pre-existed light. So I'm asking you a question for which there's no answer. And it doesn't matter. Because they're equated. Life was the light of men. Now Jesus, later on, some of those hard statements we're going to get to later on in the Bible study, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And Jesus says, I am the light, in a different spot. Okay? So Jesus equates himself with both of these. They're set up right here at the beginning, in this prologue. Those statements that Jesus is going to make later. All right. Verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. You know, I talk about this briefly sometimes with the confirmation kids. Like, if there's a battle between lightness and darkness, who wins? Light, right? Can darkness ever overcome light? No, light dispels darkness. Because actually darkness is an absence of light. And so then I say, okay, so if there's a battle between heat and cold, which one wins? Heat. Cold is an absence of heat. So if you put hot and cold together, the hot wins. Right? Yeah, I know. If you're talking about ice cubes and on the countertop, and you end up with room temperature or lukewarm or whatever. But light always wins. The light shines in the darkness. Now the light of men, which is the light, is all relating back to verse 4. So it's coming from Jesus. The light shines in the darkness. So in a spiritual sense, any guesses what might be referred to here as darkness? Like in a philosophical sense. It's a very philosophical opening that John is giving us here. Very elegant, very poetic. What is darkness? Any guesses? Absence of God, evil is the absence of God, you might say, or darkness is the absence of God, that's right. So as soon as God is present, there is no more darkness. Yes, that's a great point. A couple of you mentioned that. But another thing, too, that came to mind for me, darkness, is intellectual sense, is the absence of intelligence or knowledge. Darkness is ignorance. Not ignorance meaning somebody's dumb or stupid. Not that. Ignorance in the plain sense means what?
You don't know.
You don't know. Ignorance is just, you don't know. I'm ignorant of what the weather's going to be tomorrow. I haven't bothered to look. Plus, you know, weathermen are wrong half the time anyway, right? So you can't always trust that anyway. So, here's the thing that came to mind as I was reading up on this and studying and putting down some notes. If somebody doesn't know something, and you teach them, or tell them, can you ever unlearn it? I don't think you can. If you have some kindergartners, what do you teach, Jen?
6th, 7th, and 8th.
Oh, okay, never mind. I was thinking you were younger grades.
I did, I used to.
Okay. If you teach a preschooler the alphabet, and their colors, and their numbers, are they going to ever unlearn it? They might forget it. They might choose to ignore that knowledge. But you can't unlearn what you've learned. So if darkness is the absence of knowledge, ignorance, the absence of knowledge about God or about Jesus, and somebody tells you about Jesus and teaches you about God and the nature of God as a Trinity and the nature of God is love, all that, if somebody teaches you that light, which is the knowledge of God, the knowledge of Jesus specifically, you are no longer in the dark. Now, you can decide to reject it, walk away from it, ignore it, bury it, which is what many unbelievers do. They hear about Jesus and they say, I'm not going to bother with that. But you can't unlearn about Jesus once somebody teaches you or tells you. Does that make sense?
You know, you know.
Once you know, yes. You know, in a bad sense, you hear, you know, some bad thing about some friend or family member, and oh, did you know they did this? And it's like, oh, I wish I hadn't told me. Now that, you know, you can't unthink that now when you know that person or when you meet with them. It kind of colors things, right? You can't undo it. That's what I'm thinking about knowledge of Jesus in a good way. When you talk to somebody about Christ who's never heard about Jesus. Now, in America, that's almost nobody. Everybody's at least heard of God and Jesus, knows of Christianity, even though big chunks of the population choose to ignore it. But if you were overseas or, you know, in some mission field where there truly are people who never heard about God or heard about Jesus, and you tell them, now they know. That gives them light. The light shines in the darkness. I like to think of this as the darkness of ignorance. And the light shines, and the darkness has not overcome it. Okay, now there's other meanings there, because I absolutely think that it's right. A few of you mentioned darkness as evil. Evil is the absence of God. And so when God comes and brings, when Jesus comes and brings the light of forgiveness and the light of faith, darkness cannot overcome it. Evil cannot win. And it doesn't. In the battle between good and evil, who always wins? Well, Jesus does. Always. Right? Okay. Questions so far or other comments? I've been talking for a bit. And see, I don't even have coffee tonight. The Wednesday class, there's some Wednesday people here. Yeah, we have coffee. And then I really go on. Yeah, where's our hand? Where's the hand? Ellen?
Well, I was talking with someone one time and I said, if there was no God, there would be nothing good in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But there also would not be any light.
Yeah, right.
It would be dark.
It would be dark and we'd all be dead. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there would be no good. And actually, I'm going to get to that in a little bit farther in the prologue. That idea comes up. So, very good. All right, continuing on. Now, this is interesting because most translations and most commentators will say that this is a parenthetical statement, verses 6, 7, and 8. Because John is going on in this very philosophical, elegant manner, talking about in him was light, the light was the light of man, the light shines in the darkness. The darkness has not overcome it. All right, who is this? Well, we think we know, and you're reading along, and then all of a sudden, screech! You know, the tires squeal. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. It almost seems like a parenthetical side statement, and many commentators and translations treat it that way. But after reading Dr. Weinrich in the commentary, he says, no, this is part of the point, because who is this John that's being referred to here? You all know the answer. We're going to find out later on as well for confirmation. John the Baptist. Now, the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all treat John the Baptist as a preacher of repentance and a baptizer. That's why he has the name John the Baptist. Okay? The Gospel of John treats John the Baptist differently. It treats John as a witness. That's the point of John. And what is he a witness about? He's a witness about the light. See, this directly relates to this. So these three verses are basically the Apostle John, the author here, saying, what I'm telling you about the Word being life, and the life is the light of men, there is a witness to this. And his name is John. He witnessed to bear witness, he came to bear witness about the light. So I'm not off my rocker here, people, John the Apostle is saying. There's a witness to this. Now I recall hearing somewhere, and hearing a lawyer say as well, the strongest testimony, the strongest evidence in a court of law is an eyewitness. It was true back then. It's still true today. Yes, you can have physical evidence, but people sometimes think you can fake it or fudge it. But if you have an eyewitness, and that's why when an eyewitness comes forward to some crime, a murder or whatever, the defense will usually try to attack the credibility of that witness, to tear them down. Because an eyewitness, throughout history, is the strongest form of testimony. The strongest form of testimony that the Word is life and the life is the light of men is the witness, John. Did he witness everything that Jesus did? Well, most of it. Not quite all of it. But he witnessed a lot of it. And he was sent from God. And he came as a witness to bear witness about the light. That, and why? That all might believe through him. Ooh. That ties in with the purpose that John is going to give us later. So right here, John is giving us some little, John the Apostle, I have to keep clarifying that, John the Apostle is giving us a preview of the purpose of the whole Bible, which he makes plain at the end. I said the whole Bible, which is true, but I meant the Gospel. John gives us a preview of the purpose of his gospel right here, which he makes plain back there in John chapter 20. Now here's an interesting thing. Some of you already know this. The word witness in Greek is martyria. I know you know it. Martyria. What does that word sound like?
Martyr.
Martyr. That is the Greek word for witness. What is the strongest way that you can witness to the truth of something, or to the veracity of something, the completeness of something? What's the strongest statement you can make as an eyewitness about something?
To die for it.
To say, I will not recant what I say. This is what I saw, and it's the truth. And somebody's holding a knife to your throat, or a gun to your head, or whatever, somebody might, mob situation. Are you really sure? Is that the truth? I'm willing to die for it. That's the truth. That's what I saw. That is a martyr, the Greek word, or translates into English as witness. Some of the strongest witness in the early church were early church believers, church fathers, church leaders, just regular Christians who were willing to die for the faith. And there were so many of them that their witness, their martyrdom, started to sway a lot more people to Christianity. I'm talking about like the first 2 centuries of Christianity, when they were highly persecuted by Jews and by Romans. Okay? Did John give his life to bear witness to the truth? Yeah, he did. He never recanted anything he said. I don't know why the word recant comes up, but I'm Lutheran. It comes up in my language. I think of Luther. Will you recant? No, I will not recant. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. Another quick thing here. Who is that hymn referring to? That all might believe through him. I should have brought my Greek New Testament in with me. I searched the Greek New Testament. There is no obvious referent. And I read the commentaries, 2 of them. And they could not decide, is this him referring to John the Baptist's testimony, witness about Jesus, that all might believe through the witness of John the Baptist, him? Or is this him, Jesus, that John came to bear witness about the truth of Jesus so that all might believe through Jesus? So if Bob were here, Bob Wolfinger, he would say, yes. He's my yes man. So the answer is, who is this him referring to, John or Jesus? The answer is yes. Don't really know. Both, probably.
The Bible says that it was not John, but Jesus Christ.
That's probably the better answer. But in the Greek text, it's really not clear. So, I would probably believe this him is likely referring to Jesus. Yeah. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. Now, verse 8 is in there for maybe a little bit of clarification, because there were some that believed John the Baptist was the Messiah. And John clearly said he wasn't. It's the Gospel of John where John the Baptist says, I must decrease, he must increase. You remember John the Baptist saying that? He's pointing his own disciples. He has his own disciples. He's pointing them away from himself and toward Jesus. Go follow him. Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. That's in the Gospel of John. All these statements are in John. It's really wonderful. So, this is a clarification, verse 8, that John the Baptist is not the Messiah, but came to bear witness with his life, martyrdom, about the true light, who is Jesus. Okay? Are you with me? All right. Questions, comments?
No, in this Luther commentary, it says he's talking about John the Baptist.
Yeah, see, that's the point. In the People's Commentary, which is published by CPH, by the way, so you're referring to this hymn at the end of verse 7.
Yes.
So in that commentary that Rich has, it says this hymn is referring to John the Baptist. But somewhere else, the Lutheran Study Bible says this hymn is referring to Jesus. There you go, even Lutherans can't agree with ourselves.
The Bob Wolfinger was right.
Yeah, exactly. Are Germans really that argumentative?
No,
we are. What?
Have you ever, I mean, I was telling some of this story when I get scolded by an 8-year-old German for crossing a very empty side street in my neighborhood that happened to have a stoplight crosswalk, and there hadn't been a car for 20 minutes while I was waiting for the bus, so I decided to start walking downtown, cross the street with no one around, and the kid went at me.
How do you know he was German, though?
I was in Germany.
Oh, you were in Germany. Very good. Yeah, that, I guess that's German. Probably. Well, I'm mostly German, and yeah, my kids are kind of, well, I shouldn't be saying that to you. Yeah, they'll argue. All right. So, let's go on. Verse 9. The true light. See, still talking about the light. Again, that's a part of the reason why at least Dr. Weinrich says in his commentary that this is not a parenthetical statement. All of this is about the light. Very poetic, still talking about the light. Who is the light? Jesus. We know that. After you read far enough, you figure it out. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. The true light. So now we have two titles already, two very poetic, philosophical, deep, and rich titles for Jesus. The Word and the Light. Actually a third one, the Life. That one we just had too. So there's three titles for Jesus. The true light, which gives light to everyone. Who? Everyone! Not just some. I mean, if you're ever having a debate with a Calvinist, they don't believe in universal justification. Okay, part of their tulip is their set of beliefs that Jesus only died for the elect or the chosen ones. That's what they claim. If any of you remember when we talked about Calvinism, Calvinist church bodies, when we did our little thing on denominations, that was quite a while ago now. Here's the passage against that. Jesus died for everyone. He gives light to everyone. Did Jesus die for the sins of every single person? Yes. So why are some not saved? They reject it. Exactly. So, but he gives light to everyone. By the way, this is where I want to bring up the point about if Jesus hadn't been in existence or hadn't died on the cross, there would be no good. Isn't that what you brought up, Ellen? I had a seminary professor, actually, I think it was Dr. Gieschen, who preached at my ordination. He said, unbelievers don't even realize that if Jesus had not come and died on the cross, they would not have the life they do. That because Jesus died for the whole world, that brings about God's grace and mercy for everyone, even those who don't believe in him. In the Small Catechism, it says that God gives bread to everyone, even to all evil people. That's a quote from our Small Catechism, right? So if Jesus hadn't died, this would be a miserable, miserable existence. We would be dominated by the devil. We would be under God's judgment, not his mercy and grace. And it would just be awful existence. But because Jesus died, he reconciled creation to God the Father, and therefore there is grace and mercy. There is some good in the world. Oh, there's a Lord of the Rings quote. For some of those who might pick up on it. Too bad Jill's not here tonight. I know she'd get it. She might give me some points, too. There is some good in the world because Jesus died. And even if you don't believe in him, you're a recipient of that. How cool is that? That's pretty neat. Gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. So there's past tense, was coming into the world. So again, what is this pointing to? What is this a reference to? What event? Christmas! Yes, Jesus' birth. Exactly. He's coming into the world. His nature changed when he was born. That he was no longer strictly divine. Now he's divine and human. The only being to have that that kind of existence. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. Now this also is yet another profound statement. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. God entered his own creation. There's no other religion where that takes place. The creator becomes one of the created. You know, if you look at polytheistic religions, Zeus and Jupiter and Mars and Apollos and all the rest of those, your Buddha or Hindu and all the rest, their gods, so-called, do not become part of creation. They lord over it. But in our case, our God became part of creation. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. Does the world know Jesus?
No.
They don't. Because they are ignorant. Right? So they're in darkness. They need to be told. Just like we needed to be told. Yeah, Mark?
In the phrase which gives light to everyone that you're talking about, is that the same as when we were studying Romans in the first chapter there, and it said that everyone knows that God is in existence because of creation?
I think so. That's a good point.
Or is that specific to Jesus?
Well, I think this is specific to Jesus. I think this is specific to Jesus. Although Paul makes the point that everyone knows of the existence of God because of creation itself. So no one is without excuse, Paul says in Romans. You're right. But here the same thing. Yeah, this is more specifically referring to Jesus. But everyone has some inkling or sense that God exists. So, that is a little hint of that in here. I think there is a connection to be made. Yeah, that's a good thought.
The sun rises, Christ says, the sun rises on the good and the bad and rains on the just and the unjust.
Yeah.
Blanket.
Mm-hmm. And that's all because of God's grace and mercy, which is all because Jesus died and rose again for the whole creation. Yeah, right. That's a good point. It rains on the just and the unjust. Yes, we just got rain. Right, Pat?
Right.
How much did we get? Anybody know?
We got 3/4 of an inch.
3/4 of an inch? Oh, very good. You must have a rain gauge.
Yes.
Very good. All right. All right. Yet the world did not know him. You cannot find out about God. See, here's another kind of rich point of theology. You can't find God. You can't find out about God. You can't search him out. We don't know anything about him. He has to come to us. And verse 11, look at that. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. Now, there's some footnotes there. What do those footnotes say? He came to his own things, his own people. Yeah, he came to his own people. In the Greek there, it is just, he came to his own. We know what that means. It's implied. He came to his own people. He came to his own children, the children of God, I guess. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. What does it mean to receive him? There's a question we can talk about.
Accepted him.
Okay, yeah, sure.
They didn't believe that he was Christ.
They didn't believe in him? Yeah, that's right. So there's belief. Belief and acceptance, sure.
Welcoming? Like a guest.
Sure. Welcoming like a guest. Yeah, they rejected him in that way too. Yep. What I put down in my notes is believe in him.
They don't take him. That's the
They don't take him.
The word shows up in other verses for like taking money.
Receiving, yeah. Taking. Yeah, right. They did not receive him. Well, you get the sense. I think it's fairly plain. They rejected him is the opposite of that. To not receive is to reject. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name. So therefore, there's a little connection that helps also enlighten us on that, what that word means. Who did receive him, who believed. So to receive him is to believe. John is, part of the Gospel of John is he's pointing out that Jesus didn't come just for Jews. He's not just the Messiah for God's people, the Jews, the Israelites. He's for everybody.
Thinking like receiving payment.
Mm-hmm.
It shows up in other verses as receiving, like when you receive money or receive a treasure, and his own people did not receive that treasure.
Sure.
To you, solely for them.
When this word would be used in the sense of monetary payment, yeah, you're right. Jesus is a treasure. And you're rejecting that treasure. You're not receiving that treasure. And, you know, it's being given right to them. Some of them received it. Some of them believed in him, but some of them did not. Now, I like this also in verse 12. But to all who did receive him, who believed, what? In his name. In his name. Is it okay that, are you saved just by having belief? Yeah, I have faith. Am I going to be saved? There's a missing question there if somebody says that to you. Well, I have faith. Am I going to be saved? The question is, faith in what? Right. Yeah, I have faith that when I walk outside, I'm going to get wet because it's raining out. Well, that's a false faith because it's not raining out. Right? So you have to have faith in something. If I can give you just a little bit of a lecture real quick, kind of a side note, and we'll call it our field trip for the night. How about that? Do we have time? Yeah, I got a little bit of time. Our field trip for the night. I remember one of my homiletics professors talking about preaching about faith, and he said too many pastors, especially non-Lutheran pastors, less so Lutheran pastors, it's drilled into our heads, talk about faith. Preach about faith. You need to have faith. You got to be saved by faith. And this homiletics professor said, don't tell them they need to have faith. Preach to them faith. Give them faith through your preaching. You don't even have to use the word faith. Now, how does the Holy Spirit give you faith through preaching? By teaching you about Jesus. So, by me standing up there and preaching, you're a sinner, but Jesus died for you, so you are forgiven. Did I use the word faith? No. But did I just strengthen you in faith? Yes. Didn't even use the word faith. So, and I hear this mistake made by a lot of, especially non-Lutheran pastors. They preach about faith. Oh, you need to have faith. You know, you need to have faith. First of all, they don't say faith in what. Secondly, tell them about Jesus and you're giving them faith. Don't tell them to have faith. Does that make sense? Sorry, I'm on a little bit of a soapbox. But I hear this sometimes. Rarely among Lutheran pastors, although occasionally. All right. So, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. That is awesome. So right here again, John the Apostle is opening up, is introducing the idea that Jesus did not come just for the Jews, but for all people. All people who believed in his name. And I like this word right. I looked that one up. Well, I looked them all up. I read through it. It's the word exousia, which means power. That would be another way to translate this. He gave the power to become the children of God. He gave the right to become children of God. Do you have rights from God? Well, yeah, you do have rights from God. You have rights from the government? Sorry, that's a trick question. Yeah, you used to. They're kind of being eroded, aren't they? Yeah. Well, we do have rights. As human beings, you have a right. God-given rights. We recognize that. But do you also have power? What is the difference between a right and power?
The ability to exert.
The ability to exert. Okay.
One's coming from above, and the other one is that you are the above.
Okay. A right comes from outside you, but a power comes from within inside you? Would that be a way to say that? Yeah. Coming from above versus you are above? Yeah. Sure. Both of these ideas are wrapped up in this word exousia, which is the right. He gave the right to become children of God. So, on the one hand, it's given to you from above. It's a right given to you by God. Because you simply have faith in what was given to you, you believed in his name, therefore God bestows upon you the title, the honor of being a child of God. Okay? On the other hand, you also have the power, you have the ability, and as we know as Lutherans, the ability to reject from being a child of God. You can reject that faith. So by not rejecting it, you are a child of God. So some of that power comes from within. Right is a, his, something I wrote down in my notes. The term right is a legal term. Something you are given a right to. Power is an authority term. Do you have the authority to become a child of God? On your own, no. But because of your faith in Jesus, yes. It's Jesus who gives you the authority to become a child of God. All right, verse 13. Who were born, not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So what does this mean? We're children of God, but not by being born. Not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man. There's three phrases there, referring to being born. What do those three phrases mean? Now, the most common understanding of them is it's just three different ways to express the idea of physical birth. Procreation, the fact that you exist in the body, okay? So you were not born, this is not referring to becoming a child of God through your physical birth, your being made by your parents. That's not what this is referring to. And then the most common understanding is in three ways that that happens, not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man. So all referencing the procreative act, okay, if you will. It's not through physical birth that you become a child of God. Now, Luther has a different twist on this. I found this in Luther's commentary. It was quite interesting. Luther says that these three phrases are referring to three different ways of becoming a child of someone in an earthly sense. So he says, not of blood is referring to a natural physical birth from your parents, procreation. Not, nor of the will of the flesh, he says, is becoming the son of someone or the daughter through adoption. The will of the flesh. Somebody in the body says, I want a child, you know, we can't have children, or maybe, you know, some other issue, whatever. So we're going to adopt. So Luther reads that as the will of the flesh. Nor of the will of man, he reads that as a proclamation of some honorific title. Like a king bestowing the honor of being a prince upon someone, making them his son, or declaring them his heir, that type of thing. So he refers these three phrases to refer to three different methods of becoming a son or daughter of a parent, of an earthly parent. And that's not what, and John, of course, is saying, what, either interpretation is fine. Okay? Whether you want to agree with Luther or whether you want to say it's just three different ways to refer to being born. John the Apostle is saying that's not what we're talking about. You have the right to become children of God, not through natural means, but of God. How do you become a child of God? Through the work of God. What, by what means does that happen? You know the answer. Baptism. Right. So here is a very slight hint of yet another sub-theme within the Gospel of John, and that is baptism. John is going to talk about how Jesus died for all, and salvation and forgiveness are for all, Jews and Gentiles, and how do you become one of those saved? Through baptism. He never uses the word baptism throughout the whole Gospel. But there's lots of descriptions and hints at it, which I will pull out as we go along throughout this Bible study. Okay? A lot of it. Becoming a child of God only happens through God's work in baptism.
It echoes, how can I be reborn?
Yes.
I can't go back into my mother's womb.
Yes, John 3, talking with Nicodemus. Exactly right. We're going to hear a lot about this baptism stuff. That's right. Alright. Other comments or questions? Are your minds abuzz? Is it too much thinking? you shake your head no, Delmar, and yet you've got this...
Well, I'm thinking.
Yes, you've got this very focused look on your face.
Yeah, but your question is too much thinking.
Okay.
No.
All right. Good. You're right. That was my question. All right, verse 14. You've heard this. This is a very well-known verse, and it's a wonderful verse. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word became flesh. So now He's still in that philosophical mode, and now He's starting to zero in and tell us a little bit more about who the Logos is, who the Word is. The Word became flesh. When did that happen? We've already had a hint at it. Christmas, right? The Word became flesh on Christmas and dwelt among us. I have a number of fellow pastors who get a little, you know, disappointed in the translation here, because the word dwelt is the word tabernacled. That's the actual Greek word there. I did look it up, but I don't remember what the Greek word was. But the Greek word there means tabernacle. Now, when you think of tabernacle, what do you think of?
A grand church.
Okay. The word tabernacle in the Old Testament, what does it make you think of?
The temple, the tent.
Where did it first come about? When they were wandering in the wilderness and God gave Moses directions to build a tabernacle, which they did. And it was collapsible. It was very ornate, very elegant. They would take it down every time they were commanded by God to move, and they'd set it up again, and eventually it ended up in Jerusalem and ended up being the precursor, the forerunner of the temple. And what did the tabernacle, throughout that history of Israel, what was the tabernacle the place of? God's presence. It was the place of God's presence. After Moses and the people finished making the tabernacle, God's presence settled upon it in the form of a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. And when Solomon ended up replacing the tabernacle with the temple, it says in 1 Kings, and the glory of God settled upon it in the form of a cloud. It was shrouded in a cloud, and at that moment the people knew that God's presence was in the temple. And by the way, it remained in the temple until they were taken into captivity in Babylon. So the temple was the presence of God. They knew, God's Old Testament people, the Hebrews, knew they could go to the tabernacle or go to the temple and be in the presence of God and offer there their sacrifices and hear there from the priests the word of forgiveness or the word of teaching or the word of God's law, etc. That's where God's presence was. So now that you understand a little bit about this weighted word, tabernacle, the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. That directly relates to the Old Testament. A Hebrew person reading this, even in Greek, would hear that word tabernacled, and he would say, oh, what is the new temple? You know the answer. Jesus. Where do you find the presence of God now in this New Testament age in which we live? Where is the presence of God? It's in Jesus. And we have a very real presence of Jesus with us every other Sunday. Sometimes three times a month, right? Jesus is present in the Lord's Supper. And that is the presence of God among us. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. If you want to be in God's presence nowadays, you need to be with Jesus. And we are that in a very real way when we have the Lord's Supper. And we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Glory. When you think of the word glory, what do you think of? What does the word glory mean?
I think of the angels on Christmas.
Angels on Christmas. That's a good image.
Oh.
Is that how they go?
Yeah.
Sure.
Divinity.
Okay, sure.
Light. Think of the best sunrise. sunrise you've ever seen in your life.
That is glorious. I agree with you. Glory has an association with light, sure.
Doxology, doxa.
Yes. The word glory is doxa in Greek, and so doxology means glory. Glory to God. All right, any other thoughts on glory?
Magnificence.
That's a great word. Magnificence. Is a king or a queen in all their splendor magnificent? You know, I saw a picture with the princes, William and Henry, in their uniforms. And I don't think there was a spare spot on their uniform where there wasn't some patch or medal or band or something. And I'm like, I bet all that has meaning to British people or royalty. And I'm like, holy cow, how heavy would that jacket be? It's got all that stuff on it. But on the one hand, it was magnificent. I thought, well, that's pretty impressive. Magnificent, glory. Glory is all of that. Elegance. Honor. Glory includes praise. Recognition. Glory is a huge word. In the Hebrew language, the word glory, and I don't remember what it is in Hebrew, I'd have to look it up again. But Hebrew is, kavod. That's the word in Hebrew. It's extremely weighted with a lot of meaning to the Hebrew people. Glory. The glory of the Lord. So when the angels would sing about the glory of the Lord shone round about them. You know, the glory of the Lord settled upon the temple. That has a lot of meaning. And it also means the presence of God. Now here's an interesting thing that John the Apostle is setting us up for reading this gospel. The Hebrew people back then and us today, we think of glory as this great and magnificent thing.
Scary. The shepherds were sore afraid.
They were sore afraid. The glory can be so overwhelming that it can cause you to be fearful. However, as we read through the Gospel of John, we're going to come upon a new understanding of glory. And I'm not going to tell you this other than I'm going to salt your interest by saying I give you the answer in tomorrow's sermon in Holy Cross Day. So come tomorrow and you'll get the answer. Or continue attending this Bible study till the end, and you'll also get the answer.
Is it either or?
It's actually the same. Because our gospel text tomorrow for Holy Cross Day is from John chapter 20. And it talks about the glory of Jesus. And that's part of what I talk about in the sermon, which we will get to in here as well. So John is setting us up. I'm giving you lots of hints so you know where this is going. So our common understanding of glory is not where John the Apostle leads us on our journey through this gospel. Okay? We're going to end up with a new understanding of glory. All right. I think of this, I don't know why, still on the topic of glory, I was thinking, do all of you have glory? From a spiritual standpoint, yeah, you do. You have glory. You've been given the glory of God. But just in our earthly sense, what would be my glory? How would you, if somebody says, what is your glory? What do you glory in? What would your answer be for any of you? Well, I don't know why this thought came into my mind, but again, it relates to the Lutheran doctrine of vocation. The glory of a plumber is to have a perfectly done plumbing job. That's to his glory. Right? Wow, look at that! The glory of a baker is to have the tastiest muffins or cake or bread you can possibly have. That's the glory of a baker, right?
When all the kids come home, you say that grandma's in her glory.
Grandma's in her glory because the grandkids are there. That's the definition of a grandma. It's with grandkids, right? Yes. So the glory of a grandma is her grandkids. You have different levels of glory, different aspects of glory. So, you know, like, what is my glory? Well, on one hand, my family. On another hand, my church. You guys are my glory. I'm proud of you. And I'm glad, I'm honored to be able to teach you and preach to you. You're my glory. What's your glory? In an earthly sense, you all have glory. You see where I'm going with this? What is the glory of God? The glory of God. The pinnacle of His creation. That of which He is most proud. That of which He was willing to sacrifice His Son for. What is the glory of God? You! You are the glory of God. How tremendous is that? We have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. His glory is you. His glory is the forgiveness and the salvation of you. There again, I've given you more hints on where John is going to be leading us in this gospel to redefine this word glory. I would call that a secondary theme, not the primary theme of this gospel. Okay? And glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. That just sounds so wonderful, doesn't it? Grace and truth. And what is grace? God's riches at Christ's expense. Yep. It's gift. Pure gift. Versus when you hear grace and mercy, here it's grace and truth. Grace and mercy. What is mercy?
Forgiveness.
Yes, forgiveness. The way I explain it, try to explain it simply to the kids, is mercy is not being punished for what you deserve. Grace is getting a gift or a blessing that you don't deserve. Does that make sense? Grace and mercy. So here's grace and truth. The truth is, God is gracious to you. Those terms are a little bit intertwined as well. And then verse 15, John bore witness about Him, the light, the Word, Jesus, and cried out, "This was He of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me,' because He was before me." Now that, again, the translation treats it as a parenthetical statement, but it's really not, because John is the martyria, the witness about Jesus, that He is greater than all. So that's what he's referring to here. That even though the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and therefore, in a strictly cultural sense, that which came earlier is of higher honor. That's a Middle Eastern understanding. That's a fairly common human understanding. Should you always honor your elders? Yeah. Should you honor your ancestors from way before? Yes. Whatever came before is always worthy of higher honor. Well, Jesus came and dwelt among us, but even though He came after us, He comes after me, ranks before me. So John is witnessing here to the fact, John the Baptist is witnessing here to the fact that Jesus existed, pre-existed creation, even though He was born at a point in time, yet He has higher honor and higher glory than anything else in creation. Okay, so it's not really a parenthetical statement, as they point out there. He who comes after me ranks before me, because He was before me. I need to remind my boys that I'm before them, so they need to honor me. No, that's kind of an arrogant statement, isn't it? Anyway, 16, for from His fullness we have all received grace upon grace. Here again is another wonderful statement, and there's some disagreement as to what grace upon grace means. For from His fullness we have all received grace upon grace. Grace, gift, God's riches at Christ's expense. You can think of it that way too. It's pure gift, it's pure blessing. So from His fullness, from the fullness of Christ, meaning both divine and human, so referring to Jesus as the Messiah, from His fullness we have all received grace upon grace. What does grace upon grace mean? There's really two meanings for it that I read two different commentaries. On the one hand, grace upon grace is a reference to gifts and more gifts and more gifts, more blessings and more blessings and more blessings. God will continue to bless you. The flip side of that is, and this comes from Dr. Weinrich, I'm really getting to like him a lot. I did have him as a professor, by the way. He's still there teaching. That he's talking about, and part of it is he looked at the word upon, grace upon grace. Grace in place of grace.
Grace for grace, anti.
Yes, grace for grace, or grace in place of grace would be an alternate way of translating this. Well, what that means is grace replacing grace. And Dr. Weinrich points out, because he then refers to John the Apostle, refers then to the law given through Moses. What he's talking about here is the very first form of grace given to God's people, the children of Israel in the Old Testament, was the gift of the law and the gift of the sacrificial rites to point them to the forgiveness of the Messiah who was to come. The promise of the future Messiah. That was grace to God's people in the Old Testament. However, that grace, given back then, is replaced by a greater grace. A more complete grace. Who is that greater grace given to all of God's creation? Jesus. So Jesus, who is grace, replaces the grace of the Old Testament, which was the law and the sacrifices, etc. I like that, because then John the Apostle continues, for the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So see, in the context, it actually does make sense. It's not just grace upon grace, meaning blessings and more blessings and more blessings, although you can think of it that way. But it's really the new grace replaces the old grace. The old grace of the Old Testament, given the law given through Moses. Is God's law good? Yes. It gives us direction. It gives us guidance. It gives us wisdom. We often think of the law, especially as Lutherans, as thou shalt not. So all of God's rules, well, it is a little part of it. But the law was a lot more than that, too. The law given through Moses is replaced by grace and truth from Jesus Christ. There it is.
New covenant.
The new covenant. That's right. The new covenant. Verse 18, no one has ever seen God. Period. There should be a kind of an end right there. No one has ever seen God. The only God. Now this is a little confusing. What does the footnote say there? The only one who is God. Yeah, I don't like that either. Here's what I would say, because this would totally help to clarify it. I wish they had done this. That word only is the word monogenes. I don't know that word will mean anything to you.
Begotten.
Only begotten. That word only, monogenes in the Greek. Sorry, I'm bringing a lot of Greek out. This won't continue throughout the class. Don't bury your head in the sand. It may happen a little bit here and there, but this is the prologue, so there's a lot of it there. The word only begotten there, monogenes, it's the same word as in John 3:16, the only begotten Son. Same word. John 3:16 there is the same word here. So I think a better translation here, because it's beautiful in the Greek. No one has ever seen God, but the only begotten one who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Who is the only begotten one? Jesus. So see, it's very clear there. I think in this English, this is the one fault I have with the English translation of this prologue, this first part of the chapter. It's the only place where I would be critical of it. I think that should have said, the only begotten one. That would directly relate it to John 3:16, which is correct. And it also points out, this is a reference to Jesus, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Jesus is the one who reveals God the Father. You want to know about God? You look to Jesus.
I don't like the way they don't capitalize the pronouns when they're talking about God and Jesus anymore. They seem not to do that in the latest Bibles.
Really? Like in ESV too?
Yeah, well, there they didn't.
You mean like this he right here?
Yeah.
That doesn't really bother me. Yeah, I know. Yeah. The only problem with that is sometimes then you're at the mercy of what the translator thinks. Like that hymn. Remember that hymn back up there? Where is that hymn referred to John the Baptist, or does that hymn refer to Jesus? And one Lutheran commentary says it refers to John the Baptist, and another Lutheran commentary says it refers to Jesus. Well, then if the translators take it upon themselves to capitalize that hymn, that hymn meaning H-I-M, not Y-M-N, then they're inserting their interpretation. So in a certain sense, it's better to leave everything uncapitalized, because then it's up to us to properly understand it. However, I also don't have a problem when they capitalize things. Is there one in here where there's a pronoun he? Well, that's a capital, that's a beginner. So, yeah, I don't have a fair answer for you. I don't care if it's capitalized or not, personally. Yes, some people like it being capitalized, because then you know it's referring to God. Yeah. All right. There we go. Hour and a quarter. Just a few minutes for any questions or comments?
I'd just like to point out that doxology not only has dox, the glory part, but it also has the logos in it as well.
Doxology, that's right. That's a very good point. Doxology is glory and logos, the word of glory, very literally. Delmar?
Verse 14, the wealth among us.
Yeah.
From the Greek to the English, they have replaced a noun for a verb. And you said in the Greek it means tabernacle.
It's the verb, yeah. To tent, to encamp. Skeno.
This right here?
Yeah. Yeah.
You said tabernacle.
And tabernacled among us, yes. So you make a noun into a verb. Yeah, we do that in English too.
But it would be easier if you had, instead of saying wealth, you just put in a temple, or you could put tabernacle.
There's probably other ways to translate.
It's the past tense of skeno, which means to encamp, to camp, like to sleep somewhere in a tent.
Yeah.
It's the verb.
It is a verb form of a noun.
It is a verb form of a noun, to encamp.
Yeah. And John does this, Paul does this a lot. They coin new words in Greek. So if you're fluent in Greek, in Koine Greek, biblical Greek, you could read through all other sorts of Greek literature, and then all of a sudden you'd read Paul, for instance. He does this a lot. He makes new words. He coins new words. We do that in English, too. I mean, people do that. There's new words popping up in the English language all the time from some famous person says it, and all of a sudden it's part of our language. So... All right, good. Other questions? Comments?
Well, I think when he keeps referring to John the Baptist, I always think about in the Old Testament, they said you had to have two or three witnesses.
Right.
So you have the Apostle John, and now he's referring to John the Baptist. Now you have your two witnesses to say.
Well, okay.
You were talking about witnesses.
Yeah, that's fair. There's two witnesses. John, the one who's writing this, and John the Baptist, who died for it. Yeah, you're right. Good. All right, good. So, here's the last question for you. Should we rise and say the Lord's Prayer, or should we rise and sing the doxology, since we talked about the doxology?
Doxology.
Well, okay. Let's do that. Except Bob Beeson usually starts us. So, Jen, are you going to start
with the right
key?
How high do you want
to
go?
Not too high.
Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Thanks.